From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Friday, May 1st, 2015. Live from Baltimore, activist Davon Love will join us to discuss the latest on the protest against police and the death of Freddie Gray. And we have breaking news this morning that charges have been filed against police officers involved in Gray's arrest. And American Apparel workers are filing a lawsuit after they were fired. They'll be marching for May Day. Activist Nativa Lopez will discuss their fight. Plus, Australia's Aboriginal population is facing an existential threat from Tony Abbott's government. We'll speak with an Indigenous activist visiting from Australia about a global campaign to raise awareness. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan, Assistant Professor of Journalism Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
Yemen's news service has announced this morning that warplanes dropping bombs on Sana'a resulted in at least 20 deaths and 50 injuries. Yemenis on the ground said at least 8 to 10 people had been killed. A number of people were trapped under rubble, and medical personnel were working to rescue them. Saudi Arabia, with logistical support from the U.S., has been waging a relentless war on Yemen in retaliation for takeover by Houthi rebels. Meanwhile, the House Armed Services Committee yesterday voted to authorize $200 million in U.S. support for the Ukrainian government fighting against Russia and Russian-backed rebels. Committee members would like it to fund lethal weapons of a defensive nature. Some U.S. troops are already in Ukraine to provide training. Christina, do these two stories illustrate to you how destructive U.S. military force and political influence are around the world?
Well, definitely. I think not only destructive in terms of producing violence, but I think what we can see is inability to move forward from this historical past. So, for instance, on the one hand, you have a Saudi-led coalition, which is also helped by the U.S. selling weapons to coalition states. And anytime, as we have seen, that the U.S. has intervened in the Middle East, historically, the consequences have been exacerbated. On the other hand, you have the U.S. has its hands in Ukraine, which, of course, should also be concerning, because what I see is an extension of Cold War politics. So anytime I hear anti-Russian aggression discourse, I also hear communist aggression rhetoric. And so what we have here is this language that's West versus East, which is often equated to good versus evil. Then you have the US versus Russia, which is also reminiscent of this battle for imperialism that consumed both states during the 20th century.
Right.
So I think we need to look at the violence and the political rhetoric that's happening.
And a new study released today has found that the cost of renting homes in the United States has jumped significantly, adding to the financial burden most ordinary Americans face. The nonprofit group Enterprise Community Partners analyzed census data to find that more than a quarter of Americans are now spending at least half their income on rent each month. It's a number that has risen 26% since 2007. The reasons for the statistic include increased demand for rental housing due to foreclosures and stagnant wages that have not kept up with rising rents. The editorial board of the New York Times today, on May Day, published an op-ed criticizing low wages, saying, quote, low-wage employers in particular pay low wages because they can. And the main reason they can is that Congress has failed over decades to adequately update the minimum wage and other labor standards. Christina, does it seem as though the fight for a higher minimum wage is permeating enough into the mainstream now that we might see federal action?
Well, we hope so. At least if the New York Times is writing an editorial about it, it has moved into some sort of mainstream conversation. But I do think we should be skeptical. We've seen this happen with conversations about immigration reform, for example. So mainstream conversations seem to support a huge reform, but then political interests get in the way. And then basically we still end up where we are today without any progress on that front. And so I think in the case, for instance, of corporate interests, once corporations who benefit from corporate welfare get into the conversation and then you have lobbyists who start moving in, well, then the conversation gets co-opted. And so then 2020 passes and we're left with even worse problems.
And finally, the House Judiciary Committee just passed a bill overhauling the USA Patriot Act. The bill would curb the sweeping up of metadata by the National Security Agency that so many Americans were appalled to discover through the revelations of whistleblower Edward Snowden. It would also end the Orwellian practice by the FBI of sending national security letters and afford limited oversight of the secret FISA courts. The bill has bipartisan support and heads to the House for a full vote, where it is likely to pass. Even in the Senate, a similar bill is gaining traction, but hardliners like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell are intent on keeping the Patriot Act intact. McConnell may be fighting a losing battle. Christina, even though this is a very modest bill that would only curb metadata collection and a few other things, does it count as a small victory for civil liberties and privacy rights? And should we be surprised that it's Republicans that are leading this fight?
I do think it counts as a small victory, although we know it doesn't go nearly far enough. But, you know, this question about Republicans leading the fight is an interesting one. Now that the Senate is Republican controlled, we've seen several bipartisan bills being passed this year. And last year, however, it seemed many bills with similar popularity were being held up. So I do think we need to see recent trends as very careful strategic moves. So the Republican Party has refused to cooperate in a Democratic Senate-controlled environment. And so I don't think we should be surprised, because what they're doing is they're gearing up for the 2016 presidential election. And they know that the public has a short memory. And so they'll praise their support for these popular moderate bills, because they know what seems to completely pass the public sometimes is that this country is not a right-wing country. It's actually far from it.
Christina, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Christina Mislan is an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism and one of our daily Newsflash guest experts. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We open our show this morning with coverage of the ongoing protests in Baltimore, Maryland. And as this show is being recorded and going live, the news has just broken that Maryland State Attorney Marilyn Mosby has just decided to file criminal charges against several of the police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old African-American man who died after slipping into a coma days after his arrest. It is not yet clear exactly how many of the officers are facing charges, but Mosby did say that her office would conduct a thorough and independent investigation. She announced a range of charges against several police officers, ranging from second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter to assault and misconduct in office, and warrants have been issued for their arrest. While she announced those charges, she did note her own ties to the police community. The 35-year-old state attorney, who's only been in office for 4 months, both her mother and her father have been part of the law enforcement community. Meanwhile, a witness named Kevin Moore, who saw the arrest of Freddie Gray and then filmed part of it, has spoken out. Yesterday, speaking to news media, he described Gray being, quote, folded like he was a crab or a piece of origami during the arrest. Moore, who was a friend of Gray's, was just arrested by Baltimore police last night at gunpoint. Major solidarity demonstrations are slated to take place around the country and in Baltimore today, extending the traditional May Day labor actions to protests against police brutality of black and brown people. A 10 p.m. curfew will remain in effect through Sunday. My guest is Davon Love. He's the director of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle based in Baltimore, Maryland. He's been very active on the ground in the demonstrations. Welcome to Uprising, Davon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we have begun this program, this breaking news has just come about. I'm not sure how much you've heard of it, but I'd love to get your immediate response to this decision to file criminal charges against several of the police officers.
I think it's a great step forward. You know, it's rare that law enforcement officials get indicted for this kind of a thing. And so for this to happen, I think there are a lot of people in Baltimore that are happy that the state's attorney decided to move forward and prosecute the officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray.
Yesterday, Reuters reported that there was a preliminary report of the injury sustained by Freddie Gray that led to his death. And at that point, there was no evidence, they said in their report, that there was misconduct during the arrest. The medical examiner found, quote, Gray's catastrophic injury was caused when he was slammed into the back of the police transport van, apparently broke his neck there. And police also said that Gray sustained a head injury that matches a bolt in the back of the police van. How do you respond? It sounds as though police are desperately trying to suggest that rather than him being hurt by police during the arrest, that he injured himself inside the police van while handcuffed and in leg irons. But the videos that we've seen of him being dragged into the van shows that he was injured. He was screaming in pain.
Yeah, I mean, what you'll find is that you know, if you watch the video, I mean, to me and a lot of people here, it seems obvious what happened. But law enforcement officials are used to being able to twist the facts because of the level of protections that they're often given. You know, in order to avoid being prosecuted. And so there are laws in place here in Maryland. There's the Maryland Law Enforcement Office of Bill of Rights that provides some a series of protections that make it difficult to prosecute law enforcement officers and get the information necessary to do so. So it's actually a tremendous feat for the state's attorney to be able to put together a credible case for indicting the officers.
Now, what about the leak yesterday to the Washington Post that another prisoner who was being transported apparently in the same prison van as Freddie Gray said, had apparently said that he heard Freddie Gray banging around in the back of the van and that he thought that Gray was trying to hurt himself. Now, this prisoner, of course, didn't see Gray. He was being separated. He was separated from Gray by a metal wall. But what do you make of the release of this information?
I mean, I think it's ridiculous. But again, I mean, law enforcement officers used to being able to conjure up these kinds of stories and make them credible, because oftentimes the world isn't watching. You know, they're not used to a world where people are watching, you know, what decisions are going to be made. They used to being able to know ahead of time the kinds of things that are going to come their way. And so the leak, I think, just represents a strategic plan on the part of the institution of law enforcement, primarily the Maryland Fraternal Order of Police, to try to protect their officers, because that's really the role they've been serving, is to impede the ability to get justice and accountability for police officers.
Right. And we were even told that now that Freddie Gray had been in a car accident at some point in his life. He had had an injury in the past. There's this narrative that he's literally injured himself to death. And I don't even know how that's possible. But in the minds of police, we often see the script playing out in the arrests of African-American men in particular, particularly when there is a fatal outcome, that we're supposed to believe that black men have some sort of death wish, because they tend to just lunge for armed policemen, you know, and reach for guns where there are none. And in Freddie Gray's case, try to break his own neck and crush his own voice box. I mean, are the police relying on racist stereotypes to perpetuate these ridiculous claims that just sound completely unrealistic?
Absolutely. I mean, that's actually a great way to put it, that they used it because we live in a society that socializes us to see black people as criminal, as pathological. It helps to be the background noise to many of the narratives that people hear about black people. So that what you find is then you find people are able to make believable these stories that sound ridiculous, but because in people's minds, their notions of criminality kind of saturate in people's conscious and subconscious, then oftentimes it plays itself out in the form of, in the case of police brutality, the ability to avoid criminal prosecution for the killing of black people.
And just a quick update on the charges that were just announced. In fact, all six police officers are going to be facing criminal charges. Those were the officers who had been suspended with pay in the wake of the arrest and Freddie Gray's death. Now, let's talk about the fact that Kevin Moore, this friend of Freddie Gray's, who spoke out yesterday about what he witnessed. He was one of the two people who videotaped the aftermath of the arrest as Gray was being dragged into the police van. But he described what he saw about Gray being essentially folded like a crab or a piece of origami. And of course, now, surprise, surprise, Kevin Moore has been arrested. He was arrested last night. This reminds me, of course, of Ramsey Orta, the videographer in the New York Eric Garner case. He videotaped Eric Garner being arrested, found himself under arrest, and Ramsey Orta is still in prison.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because not funny, but interesting in the sense that, you know, it's hard for some people to imagine that an institution that's supposed to protect and serve would engage in the kind of sinister tactics that I think you're alluding to. But I think it's important for people to understand that policing in this country is an industry. Public safety is a third of the city's budget, you know, and so there's tremendous financial and political interest in maintaining the credibility and insularity of law enforcement institutions. And so it's important for us to not think that law enforcement is beyond or above doing those kinds of tactics.
And Devon, I should also mention Kevin Moore's arrest has been almost not reported in the U.S. at all yet. The Daily Mail and The Independent in the U.K. have been the two major papers that have reported Kevin Moore's arrest. What sort of chilling effect can this sort of what seems to be a retaliatory action have on this culture that we have now, you know, seen develop around us of filming police officers? This is a very important sort of cultural shift that people realize we need to hold police officers accountable. We pull out our cell phones every time we see a cop chase somebody. But of course, if we know that we ourselves might be arrested for doing that, it sends a chilling effect, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a part of the scare tactics that institutions like that use in order to try to regain the hegemonic hold they used to have in this arena. So I'm not surprised that that happened. And I think it is important for more American media to pick up on that so that people can understand exactly how sinister the structure and institution is itself.
There was also an interesting incident that took place earlier this week when CNN was doing a report on the curfew in the streets of Baltimore. They had their cameras trained live on a line of cops. Our TV audience, for our TV audience, we're going to be playing that video as we speak. CNN was essentially filming this line of cops.
Well, you know, here's it.
They were showing a young activist named Joseph Kent who was walking in front of the line of cops. Suddenly, in full view of the camera, an armored vehicle, Humvee, appeared, didn't even stop, but Kent disappeared into it. And people were outraged because it looked like this young activist had simply been kidnapped by the police. What do you make of this, Devon? I understand that he has been freed now, but you know what was seen by the CNN cameras looked like something out of a movie set in a totalitarian regime.
I mean, if you leave law enforcement to their own devices, that's how they'd operate. And that's a part of the problem with that institution. That's why it's so important to understand that they're so heavily resourced, because they can get away with that because the level of, you know, legal expertise they have on their side in terms of lobbying, prowess, and the like. So they're able to do those kinds of things given the amount of power and resources they have.
Has Joseph come out and spoken out about his experience, as far as you know?
I'm sorry?
Has Joseph Kent spoken out about his experience of being arrested, as far as you know?
Not as far as I know, not yet.
His attorney has been speaking out. There are also reports of protesters, Devon, who have been arrested and facing very high bail to the tune of $100,000. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that actually we plan to try to do something about and bring more attention to. Because that's something that's a part of the that's an impediment to being able to raise the awareness of about what's going on. If demonstrators are impeded from their ability to participate in the kind of civil disobedience and the kind of just mass demonstration that's necessary to bring attention, then it creates a situation where it's harder to organize. And so we're definitely going to be on top of that issue.
Let's talk about the issue of violence. There's been a lot of buzz in the news and from President Obama and the mayor of Baltimore condemning the violence of the so-called thugs and criminals. And even the newly appointed Attorney General Loretta Lynch, in her first official act as Attorney General, said that the violent, quote, violent protests were counterproductive to the cause of justice. But many people have shot back that that's hypocritical, because when white people riot over superficial things like sports games, there's no similar outrage and no similar labeling of criminals and thugs. People also justify it, saying a few broken windows, which can always be repaired, is what brings the much needed media attention. And the peaceful protests that don't have those violent acts are just never covered by the media. The violence does actually bring attention, even if it's unintended violence or just, you know, coming out of a place of anger. I'm wondering what your comments are on this debate.
Well, I think the eruption that happened on Monday, mm-hmm. I think provided the media they needed in order to use the narratives that they're used to deploying, in order to contextualize and rearticulate Black folks as being inherently criminal. And that criminality then is the trope that's used to then undermine the call for justice for Freddie Gray, because then all that criminality is projected onto Freddie Gray, and law enforcement is represented as a force that was attempting to deal with the inherently criminal Black folks, instead of the narrative which should be the criminality of law enforcement and their abuse of Freddie Gray.
Right. President Obama, in his remarks and his interview, also said that he thought police need to do some soul searching. And we keep hearing, you know, that body cameras are going to solve the problem. And we've heard news this week around the adoption of body cameras in Los Angeles and other parts of the country. But isn't it simpler than that if police simply are charged, you know, prosecuted, charged, and convicted? I mean, it's certainly in Baltimore, we're finally seeing some charges, but then it remains to be seen whether there'll be a conviction. But wouldn't that go a far longer way towards solving the problem of police brutality than some of these other solutions?
Absolutely. I think body cameras is kind of a Band-Aid approach. Here in Baltimore, because in the state of Maryland, we're governed by the Maryland Law Enforcement Office of Bill of Rights, community folks don't have any formal mechanism of redress in the context of dealing with police brutality, in the sense that they have the community has the power, any power, over disciplinary action with law enforcement officials. And so, you know, it's good that we got an indictment. I think we need to be mindful that the fact that we had to protest and organize to get an indictment is problematic, right?
Right.
We need a system that within its internal structure disciplines law enforcement, so that it's only in extreme cases where the state's attorney is necessary. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important for people to be mindful of the fact that the reform is still needed in terms of the institution of policing, and that we were just fortunate enough to have a brave and courageous state's attorney that was willing to prosecute for the interest of the people of Baltimore City.
And that's a really important point, Devon. Even if this is considered a minor victory to see these charges, one wonders what would have played out had there been no protest. We know that police brutality, particularly against unarmed young Black men, is something that is not at all a new phenomenon. And when there hadn't been action on the streets, or at least major action on the streets covered by media, there was barely any kind of response from police. Police have never felt that they ever needed to justify their actions.
Right. I mean, that's part of the issue. The part of the issue is that most law enforcement officers are not used to having to deal with this issue in the public. And most elected officials didn't start talking about it until it became mainstream media and mainstream news. And it's been a part of the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party, where they talk about wanting to be supportive of and fight for Black people and be sympathetic to issues of racism and structural oppression. But in the case of something like police brutality, Democrats historically have been very silent on those kinds of things. And so that, I think, adds to the significance of the indictment.
And Hillary Clinton gave a speech this week on needing to end mass incarceration. First, I wonder if she also would have even addressed this issue had it not been such an important part of the public discourse because of the hard work of activists on the ground. And second, I'm wondering, you know, about the fact that her own husband, Bill Clinton, oversaw so many of these sort of tough-on-crime measures that have led to our system today having so many people behind bars, which, of course, she never addressed or even touched on in her speech. Any thoughts on that?
Clinton presided over the biggest expansion of the carceral apparatus in this country's history. And that was a part of his strategy in terms of being a viable Democrat or viable presidential candidate and the viability of the Democratic Party was to be hard on crime. And that hard on crime strategy was something where there was a relationship between many upper class, middle class black folks. So it was kind of a relationship between Democratic Party, middle class black folks, that issues of incarceration, police brutality would go unaddressed. So that issues like things like affirmative action and others, which are important, but many benefit people, black folks who are middle and upper class. And so that coalition created a context that produced the problem of mass incarceration and exacerbated police brutality. And so hopefully what we can see now is a reconfiguration of those politics. And Hillary Clinton's shift demonstrates, I think, a keenness to the moment, understanding that that...
Devon, it looks like we just lost Devon Love. We're going to try to bring him back to finish out our conversation with him. He's joining us live from Baltimore to talk about the ongoing situation there. And the breaking news that we've had this morning is that state's attorney Marilyn Mosby has decided to charge six officers in the arrest and subsequent death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray. And Devon, you were saying?
Yeah, and so I think the shift is just the keenness in her understanding of the moment. And so I think what we'll find is a reconfiguration of politics where we can actually start to dismantle some of these big institutional ills.
And to that issue, how important is the sustaining of protests? Today is May Day. There are massive protests, I understand, that have been scheduled and organized in many parts of the country to coincide not just with what people are calling for in terms of workers' rights, which is an issue that is quite linked to police brutality. Economic injustice and police brutality are linked, and I think we don't make those links often enough or make them apparent often enough. How important is it to have sustained activism?
Well, not only just sustained activism, but particularly for black people, people of African descent, to build independent institutions so that we can sustain the movement building and also develop the power necessary to be able to address issues of police brutality from the vantage point of having the power and political organization to do so.
And what has been happening in Baltimore over the last couple of days, and what is planned specifically in Baltimore today and over the weekend? I mentioned the curfew is still going to be in place till Sunday.
So yeah, there's a curfew. There are a couple of demonstrations today in support of getting justice for Freddie Gray. There's also a lot of organizations that are coming together and gelling in order to develop an infrastructure to be able to not only just address the death of Freddie Gray, the institution of policing and law enforcement, but be a broader coalition that can engage in sustained movement building so that we're not always being in a reactive situation, but actually being able to be proactive and build a system that can address these issues from here on out. So we're not having to wait for the next incident.
Right. And there's also, finally, the question of how many National Guardsmen are still in Baltimore. Baltimore police had asked for thousands more law enforcement and officers and National Guardsmen. What's the situation? How present are armed, uniformed men in Baltimore today?
They're present in you know, places like City Hall, different courthouses. They're not very present in white communities. They're very present in communities that are predominantly black. So it just goes to show you, again, the way institutional racism operates when you're talking about policing and militarization.
Well, Devon, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
My guest, Devon Love, is with the organization Baltimore Beautiful Struggle, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and he is the director of that organization based in Baltimore, Maryland. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. American Apparel is the largest clothing manufacturer in North America, employing 9,000 people and operating in more than 240 stores in 20 different countries. The clothing chain's controversial founder and former CEO, Dov Charney, built the hipster brand by pushing social issues like gay rights and immigration reform, but drew the ire and disgust of others for the sexually exploitative ads that he personally oversaw and the onslaught of sexual harassment accusations he faced. Earlier this year, Charney was ousted and replaced by Paula Schneider, a veteran of the apparel industry. The move was partly aimed at investors concerned about the company's massive debt and losses that run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. It was also a signal that American Apparel was cleaning up its act. And on the surface, it has done just that. The new ad campaign features fully clothed women and an emphasis on social and political issues. The company even plans to start a blog about politics this summer. But in terms of workers' rights, the company continues to struggle. American Apparel has long touted its Made in the USA label and has been one of very few companies that actually hires factory workers in the US instead of in China or Bangladesh. They boast of paying workers many times more than the industry average and have taken credit for coining the term sweatshop-free. Yet the company is fighting a bid by its workers to unionize, and in early April, executives laid off 180 workers from its manufacturing sector. Now, some of them are filing a class action lawsuit, and today on May Day, they plan to march for their rights alongside other workers. Joining me on the phone today is Nativo Lopez. He's an advisor to Hermandad Mexicana and the International Brotherhood of Workers. He's been working with American Apparel workers. Welcome to Uprising, Nativo.
Good morning.
Thanks so much. Doing very well. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, can you tell us a little bit about what these workers are alleging in their lawsuit about the violation of labor laws? These are specifically the 180 workers that were fired. Three of them are saying that American Apparel violated labor laws by firing them without warning.
Yes, it's a class action lawsuit filed against the American Apparel company due to violations of federal and state law called the WARN Act. The WARN Act essentially requires an employer who intends to discharge above 50 workers at least 60 days advance notice that that layoff or termination would occur. In this particular case, production workers, sewers, for example, arrived, presented themselves for work that morning, were pulled off the machines by the Human Resources Department, taken into Human Resources, thrust in front of them a paper to sign, and dangled the check in front of them, a severance of $300, $500, and literally within 3 minutes were shuffled out the door because there was a line of other workers to sign and receive a check and to leave the premises escorted by security guards. We're talking about workers that have been in the company for 10, 12, 5, 7 years, loyal to the company, but nevertheless were discharged in a very despicable manner, uncommon for the iconic nature in which this company had built up its brand, its reputation of having a very harmonious relationship with its employees.
How does this new management compare to the earlier management on workers' rights? I mean, you mentioned the image, but in reality, was the previous management better on its treatment of workers than what this new management seems to be doing?
Well, I can tell you just from the voices of the hundreds and at one point, literally a couple of thousand, close to a couple of thousand workers that were members of the organization that I advised over the years, Hermandad Mexicana, that were employed in the company, that they knew that they could depend on 2,000 hours of work a year, almost unlimited overtime. I know workers that founded the company back in 1998 when Doug Charney opened the first shop below the freeway in Santa Fe Avenue in Los Angeles, when they only had 28 workers. There's some of those workers still in the company today, own various homes, typically were earning $30,000 a year or above, enjoyed their annual bonuses every January without fail, above standard for that particular industry, for example, for immigrant workers, both undocumented and documented, unheard of employment opportunities in America that they enjoyed under the leadership of Doug Charney.
What about the unionizing efforts? Have those efforts just sprung up since the change of management? Has there been an attempt to form a union even under Doug Charney?
My understanding back in 2009-2010, Unite Here sought to organize the workers of American Apparel. They took a shortcut. They went directly to Charney because of his image of being progressive, the above standard working condition and hours at that company, and sought to have him sign off on an agreement of car check at the company without even having spoken with the workers. His approach to the situation, and I recall very much because he called me at that time, was that he is not the spokesperson for the workers, that they would need to go speak with the workers themselves to determine whether they're interested in organizing the union, but that, and if his workers agreed to do so, that he'd be willing to sign a collective bargaining agreement. They were there for about a month attempting to meet with the workers. He allowed them on the premises to have meetings. 10, 15 workers would show up, and within a month, they left. In this particular case, since December of last year, there's been a significant reduction in the work hours of the workers, up to 30% reduction in their work hours, rolling furloughs of a week off, not paid a month amongst the workers. Their annual bonus of January has never been paid. A significant deterioration of the working conditions.
Nativo, could this...
This is what has led to them organizing the union, and over 2,000 workers within 5 weeks have already signed up to organize themselves in a union.
And could this response by the new management be because of the losses that the company is faced, or is that the justification that they're providing, that the company has hundreds of millions of dollars of debt, hasn't seen a profit in years?
Absolutely. That's the excuse that they're giving, casting everything on Doug Charney. But we know that the company has perennially been in a both a earnings mode, a profitable model. It took a significant hit in 2009 and 2010 when Department of Homeland Security intervened and forced the company to let go of some 1,500 workers, lost millions of dollars defending those workers. And so they've carried forth that debt over the years, but it's been a successful model in expanding throughout the country and keeping manufacturing jobs in America for immigrants and non-immigrants here in the Los Angeles Basin. So it's proven itself to be successful. The current management at Standard General, the New York hedge fund that illegally, fraudulently took control of the company, ousted the founder, and imposed the current management, supervised a deterioration of conditions and the fear of the workers that these production jobs will be exported to Bangladesh. By the way, this is almost the we've already surpassed the second anniversary of the death of the largest number of manufacturing workers in a similar factory apparel industry, but earning $400, $600 a year in Bangladesh. These workers here under Doug Charney were making $600 a week.
There's Nativo, it sounds as though Charney oversaw a workplace that respected workers' rights on the inside to an extent. This is not addressing the sexual harassment charges that he faced from workers, and I'm wondering if you can speak to that and also speak to the fact that under Charney's leadership, of course, the perpetuation of misogyny through American Apparel's ads was very disheartening, at least for consumers. And that the new management seems to be taking a different tack on that.
Well, I don't know that they're taking a different tack.
They seem to be.
They've actually put out, put out information that the models that are currently used, or at least under Doug Charney, were too round, were too short.
Mm-hmm.
What are they talking about? They're talking about Latinas that never had an opportunity to break into modeling a career until the development of this particular company that had the broadest diversity of color, of gender, and of races in its modeling of its product. And as far as consumers are concerned, this is a company that has $600 million in sales annually under that leadership. So I can't speak too much to your perspective about being politically correct in advertising in the use of sex and modeling, Sonali. I do know that that's an industry that that's the game. That's you know, that's what it's all about.
Okay, well, I'll have to personally disagree with you on that issue.
Well,
because
I'm concerned about the workers and the
sure.
wages that they're making, the conditions under which they're employed, and their your annual earnings, and be able to own a home, put their kids to school. This is what they had before. They don't have it now. That's why they're organizing the union. And this company has sought to intimidate the workers, prevent them from organizing, hire labor anti-union labor consultants.
Finally, Nativo, let's talk briefly about what the new CEO, Paula Schneider, has done on the issue of immigration. I think it looks like they do want to preserve their brand that they think will appeal to millennials in terms of liberal politics on the launch of a new T-shirt that that Paula Schneider and American Apparel put out in the last, actually very recently, just 2 days ago. They put out a new T-shirt that is a limited edition immigration integration shirt, 20% of proceeds from sales going to support the New Americans Opportunity Fund. And Paula Schneider said, for years, American Apparel has advocated for and worked passionately in support of immigration reform. Justice and inclusion for our immigrant communities is a core principle for us and for our valued employees. We look forward to continuing our tradition of commitment to immigration reform by launching this partnership with the California Community Foundation to help new Americans integrate into the fiber of the Los Angeles community. I suppose she could allow the justice for immigrant communities by allowing them to form a union?
Yeah, that sounded like a commercial, Sonali, but charity begins at home. If she gives full-time employment to her workers, overtime opportunity, boost the production, boost the sales. This is a company that has had sales decline 20% in the last 4 months. They're reducing production, reducing hours, intimidating their workers. You go on the property, there's about 10 security guards roaming throughout the property, preventing workers from engaging organizers that are attempting to collect cards and pass out literature. This is the kind of anti-union, anti-immigrant policies that are implemented by Paula Schneider to prevent the organization of the workers, their constitutional rights to express themselves. 12 unfair labor charges have been filed against this woman with the National Labor Relations Board because of the anti-union campaign that they've initiated against immigrant workers. So on the one hand, they're intimidating the workers that are producing American Apparel product, and on the other hand, appearing to be very charitable. The T-shirt that they're talking about, for example, just yesterday alone, workers complained to me that their supervisors went to each module to see who was going to sign up to receive that T-shirt to participate in May Day, and those that didn't sign up felt intimidated that the company was developing a profile of who was with the management and willing to wear that T-shirt and who would not, but would nevertheless march in the May Day campaign march that's being organized by the General Brotherhood of Workers. So something that has the appearance of being pro-immigrant in reality is used at the shop
right.
floor to intimidate workers not to organize themselves.
I want to thank you so much, Nativo, for joining us and helping to shed some light on this issue. We were hoping to have some workers in studio with us, but because of some of the problems you've been outlining, their work schedule prevented that. Thank you so much, Nativo.
Thank you.
Nativo Lopez is an advisor to Hermandad Mexicana and the International Brotherhood of Workers, has been working closely with American Apparel workers. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. In the United States, African Americans are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites. There are few places on the planet where such a racial disparity is seen, but in Australia, Indigenous communities are 24 times more likely to be imprisoned than non-Indigenous people, according to a report released this week. In Western Australia, where Aboriginal communities are clustered, that disparity rises to a whopping 52 times. The problem is also exacerbated among Indigenous youth. Nearly 60% of young people imprisoned in Australia are Indigenous. On the housing front, the Australian government has been waging an all-out war against Aboriginal communities, having proposed the closure of 150 communities in Western Australia. Even the United Nations' Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues has added its voice to those opposing the move. Prime Minister Tony Abbott has taken a hardline position on funding services for those communities, saying it's not the job of the taxpayers to subsidize lifestyle choices. Around the world, actions have sprung up in solidarity with Australia's Indigenous communities as part of a global awareness campaign. In Los Angeles, where this program is based, Indigenous activists from Australia will be rallying this afternoon at Echo Park. One of them is my guest, Ryan Whitewolf, an activist and a musician. Welcome to Uprising, Ryan.
Good afternoon, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, can you share a little bit about your own background? You're considered Indigenous from your father's side?
Yeah. Well, since 6 weeks old, I was raised by an Indigenous man of Australia. And so that was a pretty amazing journey, you know. So in honours and respects, like, I feel like a lot of my duty is to help the Indigenous, and especially the youth. And because I was fostered by an Indigenous man since 6 weeks, and they accept me as a Darug man, so
Darug?
Darug, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the name of the specific community?
Specific tribe over in Blue Mountains, near Sydney.
Let's turn to the major issues facing Indigenous communities in Australia. Like Native Americans, there, of course, has been a long history of oppression from the time of white settlers arriving to the shores of your country, of course. And now, is it very clear that under Prime Minister Tony Abbott, the assaults on Indigenous communities have simply escalated?
Well, honestly, like, the assaults have escalated, but I also feel that Tony Abbott just does it more blatantly, like, in front of the picture as well. It's less subtle. But at the same time, a lot of community, it's initiating a lot of community to create an evolution, to create a revolution, which creates a lot of harmony at the same time. Like, a lot of, like, all...
People are uniting.
Yeah, people are uniting, exactly. People are uniting and helping out, going into the Indigenous communities, learning songs, and it's beautiful to see the cultures actually harmonizing.
What does the proposed closure of 150 communities in Western Australia mean? Are these small towns? Are they communities that house only Aboriginal people? And where would they go if these were closed?
The communities, they house only Indigenous people, except for the caseworkers that work there. They would have to go to neighbouring communities, mainly like Western communities, modern communities. Mm-hmm. Though out of the 150 closures, there's 12,000 Indigenous that would have to be moved. Mm. And
Tony Abbott thinks it's a lifestyle choice for them to live there?
Australia's got like two worlds going on, honestly. There's like the Indigenous world where, you know, the dream time and all the stories are going on, and then there's a modern day society, and Tony Abbott definitely wants the Indigenous to integrate within the schooling system and within the employment within modern day society. Though the Indigenous, I feel, just have to be empowered in their culture. The Indigenous just have to be empowered in the sense of what they bring, because they've been there for 40,000 years, you know, and to be the people of this earth, and for that to be nurtured, for that to be empowered, be beautiful.
So are there corporate interests at work? Is the land that the communities are on being slated for other kinds of use?
There's definitely a possibility for that, because it's happened in the past. But there's no evidence for the future, but on a personal note, I feel so.
And what sort of interests might there? Are there mining interests?
There's a lot of mining interests. Australia's rich in its soil. It's got, like, gold. It's got a...
And what are the specific service cuts by the government that have already impacted Indigenous communities in Australia?
Health services, employment services, water services, all of them.
And so are they doing these cuts, claiming that this is money that they need to save? And how much money is it really saving?
Well, what's happened is Tony Abbott's said no to giving any more money to the Western Premier, Colin Barnett, and that's $90 million over 3 years. So now they're cutting that, and then the Western Premier's got to make up that money. So now they're proposing the closure of all the indigenous communities.
$90 million over 3 years is not that much.
Hmm.
But, of course, the services that it provides is quite a bit.
Yeah, the service it provides is quite a bit. But I also feel that there's got to be an evolution within, like, creating a program that's sustainable for the indigenous communities. Like, the indigenous are so empowered when they're working off the land. And for programs to be worked in that sense, for us to reflect upon that, that would be amazing.
Now, what about this report that was just released this week on incarceration rates in Australia? It sounds incredible. I mean, I couldn't believe when I was reading. Across the entire country, 24 times, Indigenous people are 24 times more likely to be incarcerated than non-Indigenous. And, I mean, that's far, far worse than the Black-White disparity here in the United States.
Yeah, well, all I have to say on that is that I've seen it personally.
Can you describe or give us some examples?
Oh, well, just being out in the desert, in the, like, rural communities, you see a lot of polarity. You see, like, two different worlds. You see the indigenous world and the modern-day Western man world. And it just needs to be brought back in harmony. All the borders need to be taken away. Like, it's just like we're all the same people.
So are indigenous people particularly profiled by police, targeted for arrest by police, over-policed?
A lot so, yeah. Definitely in the rural community aspect.
And do they see the sort of brutality that, for example, we've been seeing here against African Americans?
Yeah, there's a similar trait going on. Mm-hmm. But it's for all of us to learn from. Like, you know, we all just got to, like, put down our perception between black and white, really. You know?
How are young Indigenous people in particular faring? There's been new reports showing that suicide rates among Indigenous communities has increased, but it's also impacted young Indigenous people who are killing themselves.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely been a rise within the emotional conflict of Indigenous, and it's just reflecting all on what's happening with society, integrating with the Indigenous. But
are there lack of economic opportunities for young people? Do they have a hard time finding jobs?
Lack of economic, there are so in a sense. There are a lot of programs, though, like supporting, like, the Indigenous, like, empowerment, the Indigenous youth empowerment, like AIM, Australian Indigenous, like, mentoring experience, and also Desert P, which, like, go out and do music videos and, like...
So there are some programs that are specifically aimed, but Abbott is trying to dismantle some of them.
Yeah, I don't know if Abbott's trying to dismantle any of them, but except for, like, the primal services. Like,
right. What about ordinary Australians, progressive organizations, non-Indigenous Australians? What sort of support is there? John Pilger, who is Australian, but I believe lives in the UK now, wrote a very important op-ed article in the Guardian newspaper about this. Do activists and journalists like him cover these issues?
Yeah, in a sense, yeah, a lot. There's like a documentary called Utopia that covers a lot of these issues. But there's also a lot of people, like, integrating from all society, like, you know, like, just as AIM and all these different projects that, like, they're coming into communities and showing their support. Mm-hmm. See, that's what it's initiating. All of this uprises initiating a change for us to all come together and unite in a way.
And tell us about the global campaign that you're part of to raise awareness of the forced closures of the Indigenous communities, the 150 communities in Western Australia. Where else have you traveled to in addition to Los Angeles to raise this issue? What sort of response have you had?
Well, the honest truth is that, like, I'm mainly just an advocate for the youth, advocate for foster youth, and SOS Black Australia. The organisation, they contacted me once they knew that I was touring in America.
Mm.
So my position with them is just to speak truth on what I feel that needs to happen with the youth.
So you are a performer. You're going to be performing at a rally happening in Los Angeles this afternoon at 1 p.m. at Echo Park Lake on the northwest corner afternoon for our Southern California audience. I'm wondering if you can give us a preview of your music for our audience.
I'd love to.
And my guest, Ryan Whitewolf, pulling out his guitar right now.
Thank you. So there was a boy named with a heart of steel. Pretty open and dense, he made you feel. Breaking silence when he sung with the elder that he brung. He's raised in dinners, like breaking through the predator soul. He was born half black and white. That the schools like to set him, so he started to fight. Breaking blame, breaking chains, breaking side of shame. For the walk, he uncovered the songs of his father's soul. Put down his fist so something bigger exists. It's time to live prophecy, freedom over democracy. His heart's the sound, he started to live. And the songs, the melodies, they started to breathe. Is there anybody out there to look past the borders that we made? For the rhythms of nature, take a step and finally breathe.
Ryan White Wolf, thank you so much for that small preview of the performance that you're going to be giving this afternoon, the event for our Southern California audience happening at 1 p.m. at Echo Park Lake. Ryan, do you see your music as part of your activism?
Definitely.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so
much.
And
give out the website that you mentioned again, and any place that people can find your music as well.
Just contact me on Facebook or Bandcamp under Ryan White Wolf, facebook.com/RyanWhiteWolf.
Thank you so much, and we'll post that information to our website at uprisingwithsonali.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Ryan White Wolf is an activist and musician, and we've been talking about issues facing Australia's Indigenous communities. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. And Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/UprisingWithSonali. Our website is UprisingWithSonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday.